A friend of mine once told me that she was surprised to learn that the bow and arrow are two different things. She had thought the term bow and arrow referred to a singular weapon. It was only when she picked one up and held it in her hands that she realized that there was both a bow and an arrow. Now, I'm not exactly sure how she came to think that, but I also know that I've been confused about strange things in the past. My friend was able to laugh it off, and neither of us made very much of it. But as I was pondering this sermon, the difference between these two items, the bow and the arrow, came to mind. The bow is flexible. It's supple. It needs to bend to change its shape. If the wood or the string is too dry, it will snap. Its function will be destroyed. The arrow, on the other hand, is a rigid thing. Its structure is not to bend, but to pierce, not to curve, but to impale. I will return to that difference in a bit. For now, I want to turn to a New York Times op-ed published over the summer. It is called "In Politics, Apologies Are for Losers." The author, Cass Sunstein, begins the piece by asking this: suppose that a public figure has said or done something that many people consider offensive, outrageous, or despicable. For example, lied about his military service or insulted people's religious convictions. Should he apologize? Let's assume that his goal is not to be a good person, but rather only to improve his standing, to increase the chance that he will get elected, get confirmed by the Senate, or keep his job. Recent evidence converges upon a single answer, writes Sunstein. Apology is a risky strategy. Now, the article is not saying that apologizing is bad or questionable per se, but what the study found is that apologizing is more likely to damage political prospects. People were given a set of hypothetical sayings in this study, sayings that would be deemed offensive by many, and then they were attributed to a hypothetical candidate. And then one group was told that the candidate who said it had apologized, and then the other group was told that the candidate who said those things had not. The surprise is that the candidate who apologized fared worse in the opinion of the survey takers. People were less likely to support that person or vote for them for political office. Researchers were only able to speculate on the reasons. The conclusion that the author of the op-ed came to was this: people perceive an apology like they do a confession. It makes wrongdoing more salient. It can lead people to think, we thought he was a jerk, now we know he is, he admitted it. This study points to something more than just political strategy, though. What I'm finding both more interesting and fruitful is to ponder what it means in terms of a cultural diagnosis. What does it mean that apology is not, or is no longer, considered a virtue and is rather considered a liability? When we pose the question like that, a new way of looking at our culture opens up. This is what I make of it. While at one time we had certain cultural values that most agreed were legitimate reasons for acting, certain virtues that we would have agreed were legitimate ways for acting, those have played a decreasing role in public life. Instead, most values now are viewed instrumentally. Does it promote or hurt my chances for success? That is the bottom line, the only thing that we consider to be important in many ways. The problem is that the virtues do not necessarily line up with that kind of reasoning. They are not instruments for self-promotion. They do not fit neatly into an economic rationale, aid our chances in gaining political office, or improve our reputation in the eyes of others. In fact, they sometimes, at least in the short term, can damage those chances. They may not be economically or politically the most expedient things to do. In a way, it is not surprising to hear that apology can damage political standing. Offering apology and seeking forgiveness are practices that have their own ends and their own logic apart from our success in the economic or political sphere. They do not possess a simple instrumental value. They are instead virtues, practices whose good lives within them in spite of their material advantage. Shameless self-promotion here. If you want to learn more about virtues in private and public life, then you are going to want to sign up for my ethics class that starts in about a week. But inasmuch as apology is seen as pointless if it hurts our bottom line, then I think that that shows the decay that moral vocabulary has suffered in the public sphere. The philosopher Herbert Marcuse was right. We have moved towards rationalizing everything within a single dimension of economic benefit and harm, and do not know what to do with a practice that possesses a different set of reasons for acting or being in the world. We are getting into a place where we cannot even conceive of someone who would choose differently. Doing so sounds quaint and naive, like something you hear in grade school before realizing that the world just doesn't work that way. And in so much as that is true, that is precisely the problem. We no longer think that the virtues have a place in public life. They simply no longer work in the real world. The cultural diagnosis, though, goes deeper. You see, the way that apology and the admission of wrongdoing could be mitigated is through a cultural practice of forgiveness and reconciliation. But as the article pointed out, many people do not take confession as an opportunity for forgiveness and for moving forward towards some kind of shared future. Instead, they view it as confirmation that the person is indeed bad. In this climate, to confess is to admit that you are unredeemable. To admit that you are unredeemable. This kind of logic exposes a deep rot at the heart of our public life. In this formulation, there's no possibility of apology or forgiveness. Instead, confession simply confirms how bad one truly is, and with no possibility of mitigating that, we are then trapped within a disastrous cycle. Desmond Tutu and others realized this in South Africa. If there was no possibility for confession or forgiveness, then we are always stuck with the injury and the hurt and the harm, never able to move forward towards healing. What Tutu feared was that eventually, without the practice of confession and the possibility of reconciliation and forgiveness, violence would have to erupt on one side or the other. It was inevitable because there was no other way to move beyond it. Eventually, the people deemed intolerable and unforgivable would have to be purged. This rot that I see at the heart of our public life is that we emphasize outrage over reconciliation, anger and invective over healing, an insatiable appetite for punishment over the possibility of a shared future. The recent talk of impeachment is only a symptom of this, where political life has lost the capacity for admission of wrongdoing and the possibility of reconciliation. Now, I'm not necessarily suggesting that the president should just be able to apologize and face no consequences. But I am instead concerned with the political rhetoric, a rhetoric that is shared on both left and right spectrums of the political field, that fails to imagine a shared future where we need to move forward together as a political community. In that lack of imagination, both sides are responsible for a politics that is rigid, consumed by outrage, and lacking in the capacity to forgive. The most cantankerous debates on right and left would find the possibility, even the concept of apology, forgiveness, and healing strange and mythical, completely outside of their language and worldview. No wonder, then, that politicians who express remorse and ask forgiveness are seen as less trustworthy and more damaged. When only the language that we have for talking about past wrongs is outrage and punitive action, any admission only begets further outrage. Another way to say this is that our cultural life fashions itself more as an arrow than it does a bow. We don't bend, we pierce. We don't flex and stretch, we seek ways to spike and skewer. But as much as that is the case, and I very much think that it is, I'm not willing to settle that for as the new reality of our life together. Instead, I am choosing to hold out some hope for a future where forgiveness is possible, where healing is prioritized, where apology is not collapsed into political suicide. And if this is going to happen anywhere and for any reason, I think it is going to happen in communities like ours, religious communities with people of goodwill and deep values that claim the virtues of civic life and refuse to let them go. It is going to happen because people like us see the vapidity, the shallowness of a logic that dismisses any value, that does not narrowly serve self-interest. It is going to happen because people like us let go of some of the outrage and hold forth the possibility of reconciliation and a life that is shared together as we move forward into the future. It is going to be because communities like ours perceive the disastrous ends of a public life without forgiveness and choose another option, another way of being, a new way of living into the future. The mystic and poet Khalil Gibran, in thinking through the complexity of life, does not counsel rigidity and forcefulness. Instead, he counsels being like the bow, being the thing that flexes and stretches, bends and releases. He counsels that we should be like the thing that is supple enough to cast forth a future whose outcome we cannot see, but can only trust. It will have to be a future with forgiveness, I think. Gibran says that takes a bending, a cheerful bending without rigidity. And his last line, which shall be my last line as well, is this: let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness. Yes, let us bend for gladness. Let us bend with forgiveness. Let us bend for life.